You're watching The Sports Objective, the podcast for Pirates. You're listening to Absolute Empowerment with Coach Jeff Connors on The Sports Objective. Join Coach C, a USA Strength and Conditioning Hall of Famer, every Monday night to see in a variety of guests, including former players, former and current coaches, pastors, and others will discuss relevant issues in coaching today's athlete, with the goal of equipping the athlete and those coaching them with the physical, mental, and spiritual armor necessary to live their best life. Here's Coach Connors.
Welcome to Absolute Empowerment. Tonight we have Dr. Samuel Sears, who is a professor in the departments of psychology and cardiovascular sciences at East Carolina University, also the associate director of ECU Cardiology Fellowship, has been a recipient of the O. Max Gardner Award, which is presented by the Board of Governors UNC system for the individual within the system who contributes to the greatest has the greatest contribution to the welfare of the human race. Very happy to have you on, Dr. Sears, and you also played receiver for the Florida Gators, correct?
Yes, sir. A long time ago, but I have that football background for sure. It still hangs around.
Well, Dr. Sears, I'm going to let you maybe talk a little bit about what you specifically do, what your level of expertise is in relationship to the fact that you are world renowned in that area.
Well, thanks, Jeff. Yeah, so I'm a professor here at East Carolina, but my practice is in cardiac psychology. So I study and take care of patients who have experienced sudden cardiac arrest and patients that receive implantable defibrillators. In addition, I take care of patients with various kinds of arrhythmias and heart failure, and specifically look at the quality of life and psychological implications of having near-death experiences, essentially, where heart disease puts my patients in great harm, potentially life-threatening situations. And we use technologies like implantable defibrillators, like pacemakers, to try to restore their life fully so that they go live life and then have the backup protection of a defibrillator. So what's most unique about my work is that here at East Carolina, we're focused on the psychology of recovery from disease. So most people think about psychologists as focused on mental illness. And while we can do that, we're particularly focused on the mental dynamics, the challenges that go along with just normal disease and how people recover from disease. So we've got a very special thing here at East Carolina, just a handful of universities around the country that are particularly focused in this way on the psychology of disease and recovery.
Well, when I listened to you speak one time, I couldn't take pictures of the slides quick enough because it was so insightful and meaningful. And that's what gave me the idea to bring you on, because I want to talk a little bit about some things regarding athletics, regarding coaches. Yes. This mental health issue now has come to the forefront in many ways with many populations now in athletics. And also, having been a collegiate coach myself for over 30 years, I've experienced this firsthand. Mm-hmm. And so the first thing that I really want to talk about to get your insight and, of course, your expert opinion is the impact of stress and basically the impact of stress on a coach's mental health. And I just want to mention a few things there with regard to my experience and the what I observed through my career is that, you know, you try to stay employed. And of course, the only way you stay employed is through winning. And then you have to count on young athletes that are 20 years old to get that done for you, because you can't go on the field for them and play the game. You may have to move your family at any time. You basically are working off usually a one-year contract. I know in my case, and a lot of strength coaches, but that has changed for the better over the years. Winning or losing is, you know, basically dictates your destiny. You could get left behind if a coach was very successful and decided to go somewhere else. So you could lose your job that way as well. Someone can come in and either retain you or not retain you. In addition to that, you have very long hours. You have, in my case, pretty much not much family time because it was about a 12-hour day working weekends. And then also in the summers, I didn't really have a chance for vacation because I had the team through the summer as well. But so just looking at all these factors with collegiate football coaches specifically is what we want to talk about. A little bit of insight there as far as how that stress could be magnified and then manifested in certain ways and what could be done possibly to help that situation.
Well, I think this is a complex problem because the job does dictate many of the factors that you described. But let's first start thinking about the idea of what is health anyway. What do we mean by how stress affects health? So health psychologists have an idea called the biopsychosocial theory of health, which is consistent with a post-World War II definition from the World Health Organization that basically defines health as biologic health, psychologic health, and social health. So the fact that stress has a direct effect on psychological functioning is obvious. That's the easy one. That is, when we put human beings in situations where they have high demands and low control over the outcome with high stakes, the mental health wear and tear is obvious. And that's exactly what you described. Essentially, coaches experience a low degree of control over the outcome and high demands in terms of workload and work stress. And the consequences for themselves and their families are unlike any job I can really think of. So the mental health health effects are obvious. Now, what about physical health? How does coaching affect that? Well, first off, when we think about how stress affects our bodies, of course, we recognize that there are direct effects between stress and the physiology of our bodies. But the easiest way to describe that is that when people are under stress, they just don't take very good care of themselves. They have less activity and exercise. They have less sleep. Their nutrition changes. Their emotional regulation changes. All of those things do affect the physiology of our bodies. So it's really simple, right? I mean, it's a Captain Obvious kind of answer in a way. But I think the challenge then becomes, who are these people that also become coaches? Well, one of the things is that we do have data about what happens to American football players. And that's something we want to get into. But many coaches are simply former football players because we don't have data. I mean, no one's ever done a study looking at the true health of coaches. I'm not sure they'd be willing to be studied the degree of scrutiny their lives have already. But there is some data about that, so I'd be happy to get into that. But in particular, you know, this idea that stress affects our health because it changes our actions and it changes our physiology and it changes our psychology. And further, we kind of disengage when all that's going on. We pull back from our social. You know, you didn't have the same support as your family when you never see them. When you're going to even have an opportunity to disclose what you're thinking and feeling if you're working as many hours as coaching demands. And coaches are pretty well recognized, so it's not like you can hide. Right. So there's a lot. There's a, I mean, the whole context of coaching is one that's ripe for the occupational effects on one's health.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen a lot with the coaches that I've been acquainted with, and I'm not going to mention any names, but I do know some coaches who have been on meds for depression, and some coaches who maybe thought that they would like to see a therapist, but that would make them soft or make them weak, and if someone found out, God forbid.
Well, just before we came on, Jeff. Tonight, Shane Beamer, the head coach of South Carolina, was found to have a broken foot today. And, you say, well, that's too bad, right? Well, how'd he get that broken foot? Well, after the loss to Florida on Saturday, apparently he kicked the wall when the adrenaline wore off, he in fact did fracture his foot. But I do want to read exactly what he said, because I think it's relevant. He says, yeah, I kicked the foot. And he said, I was really upset Saturday night because I didn't do enough to help them get over the hump and win the football game. I don't think I have to have surgery. I don't think I have to have surgery, but there is a broken bone in my foot. It hurts like you know what, but I got to show toughness and I got to fight through it. It's been one of those years. So here, you know, here's a coach, just random current event today. Here's a coach describing the very thing we're talking about. In this case, regulating emotions, being frustrated about the outcome, acknowledging that he had little control over that. In fact, I watched the press conference. And then here it is. He's actually, in this case, has an actual physical impairment from kicking the wall or whatever happened, right? It's not to single him out, but to simply show that the frustration associated with coaching has an impact on people. These are humans. Coaches are human beings. And, you know, someone threatening your job every day, there aren't many jobs like that where, you know, there's a call-in show saying, boy, that professor gave one bad lecture this week. I mean, we got to get rid of that guy. You know, he's just not a very good professor. I couldn't imagine if that happened. Boy, there'd be a lot of unemployed professors probably after some boring lectures. But, you know, those are the challenges. The upside is being a coach has a lot of fun. It has meaningful work. So it's not that they're just simply victims. They're meaningful work. They're demonstrating coping with adversity every day throughout games, throughout training. I mean, that's part of your job, too, as a strength coach, has been to be able to say that pain is good, that becoming stronger takes effort, and it takes a daily empowerment, as this podcast says. So empowering people to be the best they can be is among the most exciting jobs you can have. Running onto, you know, they don't let professors run on the field with 50,000 fans cheering them on either. You know, running through the purple haze. I wish they did before my lectures. If I could run out and have, you know, Steve the Pirate out there, and then I'd come out behind him, I'd love that. But the costs are real, and I think that's I applaud you for this podcast, because I think coaching does have great ups, but the demands and the chronicity of the stress is worrisome.
Yeah, I mean, it's risk-reward, you know, no doubt about that. I mean, you know what you're getting yourself into. But at the same time, your wife might not know at that time when you marry her what she's getting herself into. So
that's right.
There's got to be some clarity there, or you're going to run into some issues because, you know, you're not going to be home a lot. But I was very fortunate in that, you know, qualified for a lot of bowls with the teams and got to take my family on the bowl trips. And that was a great experience for them, you know, my wife and my kids and also my parents and whoever else wanted to tag along. So you know, there's some great things as well on the upside. So I wanted to ask you, like, specifically with regard to this getting into the parasympathetic state is huge right now. You hear this all the time. So someone comes to you, hey, Dr. Sears, I'm not feeling too good mentally. I feel depressed, whatever, or I've got anxiety. I can't calm down. You know, as a coach, which direction do you coach? Which direction do you counsel them? Do you want them to go into the parasympathetic state, or is it fight or flight? Do you fight or do you flight?
Well, these are tough questions. I mean, I think from the standpoint of I would say what's bothering them the most first. Usually depression is going to be a little tougher to treat than anxiety. Often we can make pretty quick improvement on anxiety by simply teaching someone how to activate the parasympathetic system, right? So helping people learn how to relax, deep breathe, helping people exercise and try to burn off some of the adrenaline and some of the stress, helping people recognize some of the ways they're thinking, the patterns of thinking that are keeping them stirred up. And I think helping them to recognize that they need support in doing that, and often talking about and approaching some of the things that are making them anxious, like, I'm going to lose my job. Well, let's talk about that. If you do lose your job, what are you going to do? How are we going to work through this? As opposed to, I don't want to tell my family, we may get fired. you know, I think talking about things does help deal with anxiety. On the depression side, of course, it can be much more complicated. Anxiety can too, but in particular, depression, a significant depression. Again, here we have to really get at getting people engaged again. Depression's a withdrawal disease as well. So there's a tendency to kind of withdraw, to sleep more or eat more, or to withdraw from social interactions, to continue to not find any pleasure in life, and the mood kind of spirals. And of course, we have to worry, I think, a little bit more around depression in terms of suicidal ideation and suicidal behavior. So we do worry about those things, and we worry about both the duration of symptoms, the intensity of symptoms, and the behaviors that follow from that. So both conditions, depression, anxiety, and they do occur often together. We usually try to find out what's bothering people the most. And usually anxiety has a more immediate type feel to it. But there are a lot of ways to break out of these things, right? They don't have to be so intractable. And I think before people come to see a psychologist, a psychiatrist, often I think they've lost a little hope. Things that they did before to get through depression, anxiety, or depressive or anxiety symptoms don't work. And so they often come in a little dejected, like, man, I'm just not tough enough. And I think coaches would demonstrate that as well.
Right. So, can you go a little bit deeper into treatment of anxiety?
Sure. So we think about anxiety as basically having three significant elements, right? So there's a physiology of anxiety, which feels like your body's running away from you, right? You can experience it as palpitations or shortness of breath or sweating, and it can feel very much like a physical disease state. Right? And it can manifest in either panic symptoms or worry symptoms or even some traumatic symptoms. But particularly the physiology of anxiety really freaks people out because it can mimic some of the cardiovascular type symptoms that everybody knows to sort of watch out for. And it leads to kind of a spiraling of symptoms that leads to sleep, you know, insomnia. And so that physiology of anxiety is part one. So we often need to get people involved in exercise and try to burn off some of that physiology, or we could use medicines. Second thing we do around the second component of anxiety we pay attention to is the cognitive or psychological. So what are people saying to themselves? So we look at self-talk and how anxiety is like, oh my gosh, there's that chest pain, I'm going to die, and how self-talk magnifies the physiologic response. And so you have sort of a multiplicative effect by the way in which you're thinking about anxiety. And then the third is behavioral, which is people trying to avoid what they're afraid of. So you see that in phobias, you see that in trauma, where people try to say, I just can't face that. I got to unplug. I just can't face what you're asking me to face. And so it's a behavioral avoidance. So we look at the physiology, the psychology, and the actions or behaviors to try to get at that. So each of those we would target. So for physiology, we would start with some deep breathing or progressive muscle relaxation. For psychology, we'd start talking about replacing or addressing some of the anxious thoughts. And then for the actions, we get people going again. We got to get them out of their shell. We got to get them out of their house. We got to get them out of the phobic behavioral pattern so that they will experience it. In short, you're not going to get better sitting in your house for much of anything. So psychology has become very focused on exercise and behavioral activation, just getting people out. So those are things we would start on right away for anxiety.
Is it anxiety that's directly related to certain vices, or what causes that behavior?
Well, I think a lot of vices are a form of distraction, which is another form of avoidance, right? So alcohol does, in fact, distract you from your feelings for a little while. Other drugs do as well. So that's an example. People carousing, right? Engaging in high-risk behaviors, driving fast, right? So we occasionally hear about NFL players who are driving 150 miles per hour, and you're like, well, why would you do that? You're a million-dollar athlete. Well, the part of it is the distraction, right? And perceived invulnerability. And so there are a lot of those components things that distract us can, particularly if we're trying to avoid a negative mood state, that helps people, at least in the short run. I think it gets at something else too, Jeff, which is coaches have a high tolerance for negative emotions. They experience big games and big losses and big opportunities and recruiting losses, and they experience those kind of in isolation, because, you know, this, they can't call into the talk show and complain about the game, and they're just as frustrated, if anything. They're more invested in the outcome than fans and faculty and alumni. So I think that these are challenges for coaches, and you know, I worry about that.
Yeah. Well, you also have the anonymous message board as well.
No question. I can't believe what's said on those boards. I hope our players stay away from it, because it's ruthless. I mean, I guess coaches are getting paid. At least the head coach is getting well paid. But boy, these, like you said, I mean, 18 to 22 year old young men trying to do their best, or female athletes, although the message board scoring are always quite as hot for them. But certainly we're talking about American football. Boy, it's tough out there.
Yeah, I've read some incredible things about myself on there, actually. So
about that, yeah. I mean, it's a little bit like doctor's reviews, right? We have the same thing with doctor's reviews, where people, you know, come in and rate their doctor, which I don't, I guess that's allowed, but there's often two sides to the story, as you guess.
Yeah, I've got some strong opinions about people who anonymously take shots at other people. You know, that's...
Yeah.
But I'll let that...
I'm not sure it does anybody much good. Right. I guess maybe there's a temporary relief of anger when, you know, that person caused me to feel bad Saturday afternoon. Well, you know, it's probably not worth impugning yourself and others.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think I mentioned this to you about 5 weeks ago. I enrolled in a health coach institute to be a health and life coach.
Yeah.
So this has been a real blessing for me to go into retirement when I did, because, you know, I'm kind of going a whole different direction now, with not only taking care of myself, but wanting to help some other people as well with some of these things I actually never thought much about before. You know, I think I had a melanoma, and I went through that, and then I had a hip replaced. You know, I was having a hard time the last year or two even running with my hip. So, and then you have inflammation as a result of that. And, you know, so, you know, sometimes, you know, you're going to get these messages, might be time to do something else.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it prompts me to tell your audience about the best study we have on football players long-term. Is a study that looked at 2,864 former NFL players. It was published in the British Medical Journal in 2022. What's interesting about it is that they compared this sample of former football players to other large American samples that we have, well-known studies. And it did show that arthritis and dementia occurred in higher rates in this 27 to, I think it was 60-year-old sample.
Yeah.
That's interesting, right? Because that means, of course, that the injuries that we compiled during football, in your case, maybe your hips, maybe not, but the injuries associated with both impact to the head as well as to musculoskeletal injuries, that they do persist. And you know that one of the ways that at least arthritis and injuries are best treated are often NSAIDs. And non-steroidal arthritis drugs are known to have other kinds of effects. Now, we swap out those side effects for the relief so we can get some rest or whatever. But there's a lot more going on here than just simply coaches are under stress. They're also former players, the vast majority of them. And so they would fall as evidence of the sample that I just reported on. So, and particularly linemen, right? Linemen represented a bigger part of the sample because there's more of them on the field and there's more linemen. And they, in fact, had even greater risk of these things. So it's not the case that coaches are simply dropped out of the sky. They're former football players, and so their health and their well-being cannot be presumed. These are the changes in you, your wisdom, if you will, about what matters in life or being healthier. And I mean, these are the things that go along. I mean, I know you're a former player, and we love the sport. Yeah, you know, it's hard to think of a sport that teaches more lessons about teams and about performance and connection and representation and guts and grit and all that stuff. But it has a cost, and you know, like all things, it's a risk and a reward.
Yeah, and I'd have to say that most of the, I guess you could say, the older coaches that I know have all had at least one concussion.
Yes.
So, and you know, and that used to be hell. You just get your bell rung, shake it off. You'll be all right, you know. And that's I know I've had at least two, maybe three.
Same. And I mean, those are now recognized as grade one and grade two concussions, right? Back then, we just didn't know. And our helmets weren't as good. But I can also tell you the strength of impact that I see in football today is not like what I remember. I mean, every tackle is a punishing tackle in the vast majority of cases I see now in major college football. Whereas back when I played, we just try to get people on the ground.
Yeah.
You know, it looks to me like, you know, there's a technique. People are going after the ball and they're making more complete contact. I think they have better equipment. They're stronger, faster, all that stuff. But it's an interesting day.
Yeah, definitely more explosive. No doubt about it. So I want to kind of get in and go back to stress for a second here and just talk about, you know, how does stress cause the decline of physical health?
Yeah. Well, as I mentioned, you know, there is some physiology to stress. We know that stress increases the inflammatory states, and inflammatory states are really the rage in medicine right now. We're trying to understand how inflammatory states change joint health, how they change cardiovascular health. I mean, it is the rage, but we're not quite sure how all of the pieces go together yet. So the main way that stress can affect us physiologically is what we think is through an inflammatory pathway. Now, the problem with stress is that, yeah, it's okay in the short run, but when you talk about a coach or a player that's had a 30, 40-year career, I mean, these are chronic stress. I mean, you know, think about Nick Saban, all these years he's coached, and you say, well, that's a pretty good grind. Now, he's also become expert probably at managing some of those stresses, but nonetheless, the chronicity of stress is really where we look for physiologic change. And it's probably via cytokines and inflammatory processes. Of course, the more simple way to talk about this, and I'll say it again and again, the simplest way to talk about how stress affects us is that we don't take good care of ourselves. We simply don't eat, exercise, sleep, and care for ourselves in the same way under high levels of stress. That's a very obvious, manifest, easy way to see. I mean, it's much harder to be to having blood draws to prove something. It's much easier to say, hey, you know, during season, how often does the head coach get out and work out? Well, I don't know, but it's probably less. And because the demands of time are so much higher, if nothing else. And if we start losing, you know, the answer that every coach starts with when they start losing is, well, I got to watch more film. I got to get more prepared. I got to do more. You know, I'm just amazed. And I'm amazed at that response by so many coaches. In fact, the only coach I can really think of that kind of blew things off a lot was Spurrier, right? So Spurrier was known for letting his assistants go home and have dinner. He was known for trying to take time on a weekend to chill. And that's just funny to me because he was very successful. But it's obvious across the NFL and major college that more is the main call, not balance.
Yeah, Steve Logan was also that way. It was like, if you can't get this work done in a certain amount of time, you're not smart enough to work for me. So, you know, I want you to go home and spend time with your family. And that was big for him.
Yeah, I love that mentality. And I think there's probably more truth to it than not, because you can never prove more work produce more wins. So you, so that is a, as a single inalienable fact is just not so, but the culture of college, the culture of coaching is more. And I'm just not sure that, I mean, in this day of analytics, I think that analytics can probably jump us ahead of the same film for the 15th time.
Right. Well, let's talk a little bit about the aging coach and a little bit about the heart as far as preventative health. You know, I've got a little book here. You may be familiar with this guy, Caldwell B. Esselstyn, mm-hmm. who claims that you can reverse heart disease. And his rules are you can't eat anything with a mother or a face. You cannot eat dairy products. You cannot consume oil of any kind. Not a drop. The Mediterranean diet, basically, he looks at as being moderate, and moderate is a killer. Generally, you cannot eat nuts or avocados. So that's pretty extreme, but I really think he's talking about people who have had, possibly already had, a heart attack.
Well, we take a little bit different approach. First off, the evidence for reversing heart disease, there is some. Dean Ornish is best known for this concept of reversing heart disease, data that's from the 1990s. Today, we think about recommending things we think people can actually do and maintain. There's just too many crash diets. There's just too many crash exercisers. There's just too many crash drinkers. Too many crash. And I think what we look for is a kinder, gentler, longer-term approach on most behaviors. I mean, I would rather see somebody walk 30 minutes, 5 days a week for the next 20 years, then see them become, I don't know, some sort of marathoner for a year and then slack off forever. This is a long game. It's a long game. Health and behavioral health in particular is a long game. And it's not always so attention getting, right? Getting up and walking in the morning is not exactly wild fun. On the other hand, it's probably one of the best things if you had to pick one thing, that'd be one thing to really focus on. It's just simply getting walking in. Another one would be probably minimizing alcohol use. Another one would be certainly managing your weight and sugars. So, you know, while I appreciate that in an ideal world with unlimited resources, you know, being able to avoid all of those things and walk the perfect line, great. But most of us don't have that. That the data just doesn't support people changing wildly and staying changed. The data suggests that people will go through, many people will buy a Peloton and sign up, but after a short period of time, they're just paying Peloton. And I think so it's not that I want to be a party pooper about that or give boring news, but we want to give news that is evidence-based and sustainable. And we just don't see that with a lot of these approaches.
Right. Well, I mean, in my class, of course, we talk about the magic plate, which is just a simple, well-balanced diet three times a day, eating up to only until you're 80% full. Making sure you have enough protein where you're going to balance the absorption of the sugars.
Yeah.
Making sure that you're drinking half your body weight in ounces per day. Some simple things like that. But choosing healthy fats, a lot of common sense stuff as well. And I think we're trying to work up to 10,000 steps a day. That's a lot of steps.
Right. Good news is 7,500 looks like a great target. And for people who are more debilitated, looks like 3,700 steps provides some health, which is what I cited earlier. Just getting out walking some helps. So the most recent data within the last month or two suggests even 3,700 steps a day has health benefits. Again, not super amazing by any means, but hey, every little bit counts. By the way, I forgot to mention, of course, no smoking. Smoking's just a non-starter. That's the obvious number one cut. But I assume that if we're talking about empowerment, most of us have, given up tobacco. Tobacco just doesn't play for health.
Right. What do you think of this vaping?
I'm worried about it. I'm worried very much about it. Lungs are very precious. I'm worried about it. I don't quite know what to make of it yet. I mean, we don't believe it's helpful. That's for sure. The question is there any sort of step down approach from tobacco to vaping to ultimately something else? We are interested in that. We have some, I'm working together with a public health professor to design some studies looking at essentially vape the device that has essential oils in it as a way to mimic the vape process without monoxide, without the toxic elements that go along with it. So we're worried about all that stuff. I'm not sure where it goes.
And what about marijuana smoke?
Well, we don't have great data about marijuana. I mean, smoke's just not good for your lungs, period.
Yeah.
I mean, I hate to throw the book at marijuana, but so far, the pharmacologic studies I've looked at, it's got a lot of placebo to it in addition to some active ingredients, and especially all the ways that it's been modified in its growth. That, again, it's another one of these, hey, without clinical trials, as professors, we're not very comfortable commenting on this stuff. We really rely on scientific data for these things. So, yeah, but of course, these questions come up all the time, and as more states legalize it, we're going to be dealing with it even more.
Yeah, and there's people still swearing up and down right now that it causes brain cell damage. So, yeah, I don't know what that research is, but
if you look at the claims that people make about marijuana, it cures so many things that we don't have any pharmacologic agents that can work all those different ways. I mean, drugs don't do that. Suggesting that there is some expectancy effects. It's like, oh, when I take this, I feel like this. And they, in fact, expect to feel that way and do feel that way. So expectancy effects are part of any chemical agent. You expect to feel calmer when you drink a beer, or you expect to feel certain ways when you take any medicines. Those are known expectancy. Some people call them placebo effects, but they're really expectancy effects.
How about blood pressure?
Well, I mean, if you think about the common pathway of disease, hypertension, high blood pressure is the common pathway. It's the one we worry most about. It's also the one that doesn't have as much intuitive appeal to people. I don't feel bad. Why are you giving me these medicines that make me tired? Because we know that the process of high blood pressure makes the organs work harder and develops the conditions by which heart disease and other vascular related problems like stroke can manifest themselves. So we do worry about blood pressure because it's such a common pathway. It's not the only way to get heart disease, but it sure is there enough. It's the usual suspect. And as you might guess, not everybody has equal access to healthcare and to blood pressure care. So people with healthcare resources are more likely to get the kinds of problems because the condition is symptomless. And so they wander around with high blood pressure, never get care until it shows up as a disease. And that making the heart work harder, the process of managing blood pressure, I mean, it is worrisome, and it's sort of an unfair disease because it affects people differently based on health disparities and inequalities.
Now, with atherosclerosis, can plaque be stabilized? Can plaque be reversed? What can be done?
Yeah, I mean, look, the main thing is we like this idea that it can be stabilized, and we have some older data that definitely says that. And the use of statins in particular seem to really help stabilize plaques. That is the goal of statins and some of the newer drugs we have that are not as commonly used, but we do have ways of doing that. So there is good evidence that we're making progress on this. Today's optimal medical therapy with a multi-target regimen of medications yes, does look like we can really help people's hearts function more at ease. We can reduce blood pressure. We can stabilize some plaques. Now, nothing's perfect, right? I think there is good news in that space, and we're going to continue to see more good news. Obviously, the story about Ozempic and the group of drugs called GLP-1 inhibitors, I mean, this is quite interesting, right? We may help a lot of people, and maybe even these linemen and these coaches that we've talked about, that maybe using some of these medications that have the side effect of weight loss, maybe that's going to be a semi-magic bullet in terms of helping our historical football players get healthier or in the future. So again, medicines have a real place here. Nobody likes polypharmacy. Nobody likes to take a big handful of pills, but it's in a pretty efficient way of getting at some of these risks.
Yeah, with statins, you hear about muscle cramping and muscle weakness. And then, of course, probably the thing that's not very appealing is some native issues with mitochondria as a result of statins.
Statins, we do have some good at news about statins. I mean, in studies that have tried to manipulate the effect, there's a study called the Samson trial that actually looked at how expectancy effects, telling somebody, hey, if you take this medicine, you might get some muscle cramping. Well, they're more likely to get it if you tell them that.
Yeah.
And so what's going on here, right? Again, expectancy. So we think the balance of benefit of statins, as much as we know right now, the balance of benefit is quite extensive. Knowing that, yeah, I mean, myalgia, that's, you know, muscle pain, muscle stiffness, myalgia does seem to occur in as many as 10% of people. But remember, the people who take statins are also highly subjective. They're very likely to have arthritis. So yeah, it's tough. I mean, is that making it worse? Wasn't it already there? These are tough, complicated issues that, you know, everyone's personal physician needs time to talk with and then support in terms of how to, you know, make a decision about whether the statin's right for you and for your health.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on who you talk to in relationship to LDL.
Yeah.
You know, how crucial is it for you to get your LDL way down? And a lot of people agree with that. My doctor agrees with it wholeheartedly. She'd like to see your LDL maybe down to like 70 or something. And so, you know, how do you feel about LDL, you know, as a marker, and how extreme, I mean, how far do you need to go before you're going to be feeling healthy or considered to be healthy with that marker?
Well, I mean, my role is so often to simply support people trying to make a decision and go with it, right, and facilitate yeah. that. The data does continue to come in from large clinical trials about cholesterol and LDL. And I mean, there is evidence that driving it lower and lower seems to be a desirable direction. But again, it's very idiosyncratic, very individual about which decisions to go with. But yes, there is evidence that driving it lower and lower as whatever that means, right? We're not even sure what that means, except
right.
you know, push the number down. Okay, but what other consequences are there, right? With each action, there is a reaction. But lowering LDL remains pretty good evidence that makes sense for many people.
Yeah, going plant-based, for instance, for someone like me, who's an older retired coach who still likes to lift weights, you know, where am I going to get my protein? Where am I going to get enough protein that I need to recover from a training bout?
That's right.
Just enough for basic survival, because protein is so important to many of your bodily functions.
Yeah.
So that's another thing that I would mention, but.
Yeah, I mean, everybody with a foot in academia and academic medicine is going to say moderation every time, because we think we're safe with that. So when you get people out on the extremes, whether they're cyclists or weightlifters or people out on the extremes or people who do nothing, sit on the couch all the time, these extremes, it can be a little bit more difficult, because we're trying to keep people moderated if you will, across multiple behaviors.
Right.
Again, it's not as much of a headline, right? Like, oh man, you know, hang upside down and eat a burger. You know, these might be more exciting headlines. But moderation and reasonableness remains part of our acumen. We don't want to take too many of these crazy rides on these dietary hikes. We've been fooled too many times.
Yeah.
Just too many times. We really try to talk about reasonable moderation.
I think the American Heart Association promotes the Mediterranean diet, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. Right. And the DASH diet, which is a very similar kind of healthy based dietary plan. Again, the research in diet is very suspect. We really have a hard time drawing firm conclusions from dietary research. It's just a very difficult, uncontrolled set of experiments. We end up with these big surveys and people recalling what they ate, and that's just not good enough science. I mean, if people were like lab rats and we could control their diet and control their life for X number of days, maybe, but boy, that would be an unethical study, right? So these are tougher issues. I didn't mean to be elusive. I just don't think you can draw a lot from these, and we're just really cautious about them.
Yeah, and then probably the final thing I want to ask you about as far as being related to male issues would be testosterone levels as you age, and how that impacts pretty much everything that, you know, that has been important to someone who's trying to gain strength or trying to maintain virility or whatever. So, you know, what do you have to say about testosterone?
Well, again, I'm a little bit cautious. I mean, we do know that low testosterone is associated with things that look a lot like depression. We do know that testosterone changes across the lifespan. It certainly changes across middle and older age. We're also pretty cautious about it. I mean, we have limited data. There is some study that seems like, okay, we don't think it's dangerous per se, but every situation is different. I certainly have patients who do take testosterone. Again, I'm kind of uncomfortable with looking for solutions outside ourselves. I'm much more comfortable with looking at solutions like exercise and other kinds of well-being strategies rather than just chasing pharmacologic solutions. Although there are cases where that's needed. Again, we have easy lab tests for that. So there can be conversations between your doctor and you about how do I look in terms of testosterone? But I mean, I got to tell you, I would be cautious about it. I don't know that we need to change the pharmacy of some of our hormones quite as much as it's tempting to do. Again, we're cautious, we're conservative, because remember, we don't want to do any harm. We want to make sure that we give advice that's stepwise, that is sustainable, and that is evidence-based, that we have good empirical evidence about the possible avenues of action.
Yeah, and I think heavier, not extremely heavier, but heavier multi-joint movements help to promote growth hormone and promote testosterone naturally. So, you know, you start taking, you know, injections of testosterone, your body shuts down, making it naturally. So, you know, there's a lot of things to consider there.
And that is a known concept. We're not positive about that, but that's a reasonable, plausible response. That supplementation just simply reduces production. We're not sure about any of those things, but I think those are the things we're talking about in the research literature.
And these age-defying gurus now are promoting peptides. I don't know, you know, so I...
Yeah, I don't have a lot of comments on those. I mean, again, we look for the best evidence.
Yeah.
Gurus, I like gurus fine, but I don't think they can represent the literature and the research and the scientific basis for what we do enough. That's why we're cautious and careful.
Yeah. A lot of money being made out there on peptides right now. So,
yeah.
So what, let's go back and talk about you a little bit. Let's go back and tell me about your background, how you got to University of Florida, where you grew up.
Yeah.
how you get into basically in your education, what you gravitated toward?
Yeah, so I grew up in Orlando, Florida, and I was a pretty good high school football player and hurdler. A lot of small schools talk with me, but I grew up in Florida. All I knew was Chris Collinsworth and the Florida Gators. yeah. And I said to myself, look, if I make one catch for the Florida Gators, it'd be better than if I led the Ivy League and the wide receiver. What good? So you're the best in the Ivy League. Nobody in Orlando would even know it. So I wanted to go to the University of Florida no matter what. I got to Florida and had multiple injuries. The first fall I got mono, so I missed most of the season because of a protection of the spleen. And then I blew out a shoulder, a dislocated shoulder that I'd hurt in high school. And then I hurt the other one. And then I blew out my knee and had an ACL repair. So I never did make that one catch, unfortunately. It took me 3 years of rehab. But it did do this for me. You know, I knew that I knew it was hard to get better. And at the University of Florida, I got a chance to be around and try to look at why do people get better? How do people recover from injuries? And I actually got a chance to be around that. And it led to my interest ultimately in psychology and ultimately in the University of Florida, which is another one of the schools like East Carolina that has the psychology of disease. So despite the fact that I had these injuries, they did in fact lead me right down the path that I wound up on. The other thing is that my time in athletics, back then we had athletic dorms. And so I stayed on as an RA in the athletic dorm for 3 of my years of graduate school. So, you know, I was the guy chasing the girls out of the dorm at 2 o'clock in the morning. It wasn't great work, but you know, people understood that was the rules at the time and it was, you know, a different time. And so that helped me a lot. So at the University of Florida, my work was around heart transplant because I got interested in how people get better. And I thought, what bigger, badder, meaner, tougher disease than needing a heart transplant? You're either going to live or die based on an operation. And so I got interested in that and had a great opportunity to study there. And that became my interest in cardiology and interested in other kinds of technologies beyond transplant, because here we are almost 30 years later, and we still transplant almost the exact number of hearts we transplanted 30 years ago. Mm. We just have not made much progress in organ donation. And so fortunately I did diversify, because you know there's only so many hearts being transplanted. And so I got interested in all the other things that we do in cardiology, and that's exploded with many different technologies. And that's how I got here, really focused on the recovery of disease. I came to East Carolina after 12 years on the faculty at the University of Florida. I was a tenured professor there at Florida. So I went there when I was 18 to catch passes, and I left when I was 39 to come to some scrappy place called East Carolina. The only thing I knew about East Carolina was I saw them play Florida once and Florida State once. And I thought, I don't know who runs that team, but that's one scrappy bunch. And that's true. They were, I think it was 47-46 in Tallahassee. And they came to Gainesville and scrapped pretty well as well. So I knew about this. I knew about the teams. I knew about the Miami Wins, frankly, because I always pay attention to whoever beats somebody that I don't like either. So East Carolina had put up a couple of big wins against Miami. So I knew about that. And I was recruited here in 2007 when they started a new PhD program in clinical health psychology, and the Heart Institute was being built.
Yeah.
And, you know, the leaders of the Heart Institute recognized, hey, maybe this guy could help us. And since then, it's just been life-changing for myself, my family, to come here, raise my children here in Greenville. Both my sons left and went to the University of Florida for college. Both have graduated and done well, but they fondly appreciate Greenville as a place to grow up and East Carolina. I think they secretly are bigger East Carolina fans than Florida fans because this is home. And, you know, it's a special place for many reasons. East Carolina is a place that does exactly what I said. It's a scrappy place that does a lot with a little, that magnifies the best of what it has. It's interpersonal. It cares about the people here. I mean, I know you could be a lot of places and been a lot of places. This is a pretty neat place.
Absolutely. Well, I had a great 18 years there, and you know, that's why I still live in this town. And my kids grew up here, so we've got a house down at Emerald Isle. So this is kind of this is our place.
Yeah, and you know, hats off to it. It's up to all of us to make this place special, and I think all of us try. This is a much more personal place. You know, universities can't love you back, but a lot of people love this university.
Right. Well, Henry Van Sant, someone who I respected very deeply, told me one time, you know, we are just stewards of this place. It's going to be here a lot longer than we are. So.
Well, he gave a lot to this place, that's for sure. So, yeah. So I'll take that as great advice.
No doubt. Well, I really appreciate you coming on, and I can't wait till you speak somewhere else, because I'm going to try to get wherever I can to listen to you, because I have a tremendous amount of respect for your knowledge. So thank you very much for your time.
Appreciate you, Jeff. Great work and contribution to East Carolina as well. And love being here. I hope I can come back. Invite me back. I'll come back and talk about something else.
Hey, I'll definitely do it. This is Jeff Connors signing off for Absolute Empowerment. We'll see you next week, and God bless. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Absolute Empowerment with Coach Jeff Connors on The Sports Objective. Join us every Monday night for a new edition of the show. Listen to the show pretty much everywhere podcasts are found. Be sure to follow us on social media at TheSportsOBJ on Twitter and TikTok, at TheSportsObjective on Instagram. Like and follow our Facebook page and subscribe to our YouTube channel. As always, we appreciate you listening to the show, and go Pirates!
Thanks, Jeff.